En coloc. Une retransmission proposée par Canal Académie.
Bechelet, for the invitation and for the honor to be included as perhaps the sole alien presence in your midst and speaking in an alien tongue, I owe him double thanks for this generous allowance in my case. I could probably handle questions afterwards if they want to address in French. You have my text in English, and I don't propose to read it to you, so I want to summarize some main points. Perhaps beginning by declaring my allegiances. I'm not an apologist for either empire. In fact, I think I'm the first paper responsible in this conference for two empires, the Persian Empire or a Iranian-based empire and the Ottoman Empire. They're both of them, of course, multi-dimensioned, and religion played an importance at different levels of the state and at different periods gained an importance that was disproportional perhaps to its importance at other times. So it's very difficult to summarize in very clear, simple terms. But what's clear is that we have an internal dimension and an external dimension in which religion can play a part for both states. It will be difficult to deal with six dimensions and two empires. Three dimensions and two empires, that would be six discussions. So I don't propose to do this in half an hour, but perhaps to begin with the absence of a concept of sacral kingship in those terms, or a definition of political legitimacy that is very explicitly based in a doctrine or a dogmatic interpretation of religious identity. It appears in their relations at the very beginning as Ismail, who took the control of the Safavid state in 1501, defined his kingship very much in sacral terms and his empire as a kind of holy empire, if you will, of the region. The reasons for this that I can't go into in detail, but yesterday we had discussion of the existence of a Turco-Mongol invader into northern India, the Mughals established under Babur, a Sunni empire explicitly, the Uzbek Shaibanids on his eastern frontiers, again a Sunni power. So in order to legitimize his new political order, if you will, he needed a means of differentiating himself. And the tribes, which were his main source of military support, were a ready tool, if you will, in establishing his kingship. Of course, the danger of basing your kingship on a basis of doctrine or sectarian identity is that if you lose any of your battles with your imperial rivals, then the notion of divine sanction, divine intervention and support for the regime because you are fighting for the right. We've had several examples throughout the conference of the forces of light against the forces of evil and so on. If you define your existence in those terms, a military defeat can be quite a blow to your imperial prestige and to your charisma and attraction as both military and spiritual leader of the faithful. So this crisis at the beginning of the creation, the foundation, if you will, of the dynasty, met its test very quickly in the case of an Ottoman challenger. The Ottomans were at that stage militarily more advanced and developed, and he received a crushing blow and defeat at the Battle of Chalderon in 1514, which was a battle that might never have happened, because the Ottomans, for their own reasons, were not terribly interested in confronting their Muslim neighbors, defining their confrontation in religious terms. There are a number of reasons for that. Sectarian identity is dangerous for an empire that has multi-regional presence, especially for an empire that has conquered territories in its early history. So we have to remember that the Ottoman Empire in 1501 was an empire established already for two centuries. And they had a territorial base in the Balkans, and they had another religious foe, the Christian West, to confront and to deal with, but not in terms that would make very, very explicit a kind of Sunni universalism as its main motive for existence and its main reason for existence, because, of course, you can win the war and lose the peace in terms of territories annexed in the Christian part of their empire that would resent the presence of an overlord or an imperial master who defined themselves in terms of this rather exclusive test of imperial loyalty and support for the dynasty. So there were many, many reasons why at the turn of the 16th century the Ottoman Empire was not anxious to engage in a second front on the east against what would have to be declared as a Muslim schismatic, heretical state whose existence had to be challenged on theological grounds. The danger of sectarian division within, of dilution of their effort internationally to confront other imperial threats and geostrategic threats, other frontiers to defend. The opening of a two-front war separated from one another by 2,000 miles in overland distance, so 1,000 miles from Constantinople to the Eastern Front and another 1,000 miles from Constantinople across the Via Maritaris to the frontier with the Habsburg Empire was something that would have challenged the resources of any state, and they needed to set priorities and to set limits on their universalism, especially one defined in terms of Sunni orthodoxy against the rest of the world. So I think those were the, first of all, Cusasia, about those two empires, this French series that you're all familiar with. Can I essentialize and simplify the role of religion as a force or an inspiration directing foreign policy, domestic policy, other aspects of their relations, especially with the wider world surrounding them. In the Middle East, a confrontational position vis-a-vis the existing powers, the Mamluks in Egypt, who were unquestionably the established empire and who were not a focus of Ottoman expansion or rivalry, really, questioning in the first century and a half or so of the empire, were weakening. The Red Sea was under threat by Portuguese navigation across, around the tip of Africa, the Horn of Africa. The Spanish were approaching Cairo overland, the presidios that were established on the North African coastline. There were reasons why a kind of response would be required at some stage to this external threat from the West, but it was postponed, let's say, at the beginning of the 16th century. there was the question of consolidating their rule in the core territories of the empire before they engaged in crusade or international adventures in an expansionist realm in the Mediterranean or in the East, that the logic was fairly clear, that they shouldn't put their hopes into a universal empire yet. They needed to build their power base and to consolidate the territories they had acquired already. The fall of Constantinople was certainly, it was captured, but it was vulnerable to attack. And there were long wars fought with Venice and others to secure those territories. So to be propelled into a second holy war on the Eastern Front against the Safavids was something that probably might not have occurred had it not been for, I think, a sort of peculiar conjuncture of events at the beginning of the 16th century. The challenge from Ismail, the Shah, founder Shah of this new political regime, was militant, millenaristic, and missionary in its attempt to win over the allegiance of the ethnically very similar, mostly Turkmen, Turkish-speaking tribes of Eastern Anatolia who formed the population at the frontier between those two empires. So there were missionaries or pilgrims or religiously enthused tribesmen, the so-called Kızılbaş. They had their emblem, the red cap. They were recognizably supporters of the Shah and of the Alid or Shiite persuasion of their spiritual leader and their military commander, and they were sent on missions into Anatolia to convert or subvert the tribal populations of the East. This was ongoing from the beginning of Shah Ismail's reign. Why did the Ottomans take so long to respond? Why was it only in 1514 that the two empires, if you will, came into direct conflict? There is a succession crisis. It's almost certain that Selim, who only held the Ottoman throne for 8 years, between 1512 and 1520, adopted a very hard-line response to the challenge posed by the regime in Iran, partly to secure his succession and to legitimize his succession within Ottoman domestic opinion. It's almost certain that, like Saladin, who was mentioned yesterday, he was a usurper, probably a parricide and a regicide as well, and he needed an exterior focus, if you will, an exterior enemy on which to focus and to combat the threat of the conversion, if you will, to the Shiite persuasion of substantial proportions of the population, Muslim population, in eastern Anatolia on the borders between his polity, which had only just reached sort of the edges of the Euphrates at that conjuncture in their history. Most of their history, as I mentioned, in the first two founding centuries, was focused against European crusade against the Ottomans to eject them from the Balkans and from their other European possessions. So the fact that a confrontation defined in religious or sectarian terms could take place at this particular point in history was perhaps accidental or perhaps inevitable, given the hard-line line taken by Ismail, that it would provoke a reaction. But the reaction was couched in similar terms, I think, because of the vulnerability of Selim's authority in the Ottoman Empire and his need to legitimize his succession and declare a holy war that could be winnable. As I mentioned, I think at the beginning of my presentation, there was an inequality in the two empires. A developed empire, an empire provided with a standing army and a tribal sort of cavalry base to support it, pitted and armed with new technology, weaponry, musket, and so on, against an adversary, Ismail, whose main support was God was on his side and would not permit him to be defeated. Of course, the obvious happened in 1514. He was very seriously defeated, and this foundation myth, if you will, of the Safavid state, that it was the kingdom of God on earth and that its adherents and religious followers would create a lasting sort of divinely sanctioned regime that would dominate in the region and proselytize and gather strength through religious attraction, of course, came to naught at that stage, early stage of the creation of this new imperial adventure. So he died in 1524, and his successors had to elaborate a new ideology, one based perhaps more on compromise and on peaceful relations with the rest of the Muslim world, giving up the attempt to sort of the final solution. Everyone must be Shia, everyone must be Sunni, and the two opposing positions. There's no potential for compromise, we heard just before, in sectarian warfare, defined in terms of sectarian difference. The Catholics will take the ears and the lips and do as they wish with them because their cause is right and because there is no possibility of compromise with the forces of evil or the Calvin who had his innermost being, was it, in the last paper? Envahi par le diable, I think was the phrase used. So this distancing of yourself from your co-religionists who have a sectarian belief which is slightly differentiated from your own creates massive problems internally. I have to mention the soldier. Soldiers, and this was mentioned also in the paper on Japan, soldiers are not theologians. And sultans and political leaders are not theologians. They will arm themselves with the rhetoric that theologians can provide to them to initiate war, to declare war, even to conduct war according to the rules of engagement that will be at least partly defined as to what is permissible by religious law and canon and custom. But primarily, soldiers are not ideologically normally. Their persona is not dominated by such concerns. If it's made to be dominated by such concerns, it tends to be a rather transitory affair. And in the Ottoman case, I must mention, this may seem a trivial point, but the sort of substantial part of the Ottoman army that was asked to anathemize the Safavid enemy and to send him to the depths of perdition because our cause is right, didn't really believe very much in the necessity of that. And it was a highly controversial thing. It was discussed earlier in the conference. Declaring war against a Muslim neighbor was exceptional, controversial, and tended not to have very long duration. So it's the exceptional circumstances of Ismail's succession coinciding with Selim's claim to political supremacy in the Ottoman and to succession to sovereignty in the Ottoman state that allowed for a time that rather irrefutable logic to be put to one side. And for the voice, if you will, of theologians and the supporters of formulators of imperial ideology to give a very religious tone to their relations. So what I'm arguing in the paper, basically, I deal with a phase that comes some 80 years after the formation of the Safavid polity, that a dilution, a moderation of the very explicit sort of sectarian identity of the dynasty takes place in the Safavid state. It's not a workable basis for the their sovereignty, the loyalty of their internal supporters, and one has all kinds of divisions and power struggles that manifest themselves immediately after the death of Shah Ismail, who was a charismatic leader, who had a loyal following, to perpetuate the fervor and the enthusiasm of the Qizilbash tribesmen, who were the main support of this notion of the manifestation of God on earth, who had right on his side, and who would create the kingdom of God on earth, and so on, was much disputed, challenged, and ultimately rejected by the later successors of Ismail. So I'm attempting in the paper to draw a sort of evolution, if you will, of the position of sectarian and sort of diametrically and polar opposition of Sunnism and Shiism as a sort of governing and animating, someone mentioned, the motor behind imperial rivalry and opposition and competition, being very much de-emphasized. And in history or in human affairs, it's my firm belief, stimulus, response, action, reaction, the Ottomans probably from the beginning were more open to the notion of a reconciliation, a mutual acceptance. They simply weren't in a position to fight the Holy Roman Empire under Charles I, who took control of most of Europe and who imprisoned the French king at Pavia in 1525, to become embroiled at the same time in Mediterranean sphere and the sphere of the borderlands of Islam, where you're chasing a heretic, a schismatic, who will not submit to a reconciliation based on doctrinal compromise. It'll have to be power politics and the use of other means of intimidation, not threat that you're anathemized and that you are demonized and you are outside the pale of the Muslim community, but that we're Muslim brothers, basically, and we need to be so that we can be united amongst ourselves while we confront a Europe in the early 16th century which is racked by sectarianism and religious war, if you will, by probably the only wars that we've been considering throughout this conference that would qualify very exactly as sectarian or religiously sectarian conflicts. So the forces restraining empires from Muslim empires, coterminous territorially, from engaging in endemic or perpetual warfare to the elimination and to the destruction of the other partner in such religiously defined conflict were many. The actors and the soldiers, I'll come back just briefly to the religious identity of the Janissary Corps. The Janissary Corps, which were the main support of the Ottoman military organization, if you will, at the heart of the state, and the main support of the authority and the power of the sovereign, were not heretics, but heterodox. They weren't very good Sunnis. They came from Christian origins. They were, some of them, even crypto-Christians. And their patron saint, if you will, their identifying figure, was a fellow called Haji Veli Bektash, a Sufi mystic, and not someone who would fit anywhere conveniently on either pole of Sunnism-Shiism, but somewhere in a sort of compromise position. And they didn't necessarily want to confront this religiously defined foe, who was ethnically the same and who in many ways was religiously the same as themselves. There was not a strong identification of the Ottoman soldiery with an enemy who was defined in those sectarian terms. And also, campaigns in the East were extremely unpopular with the Ottoman soldiery. The conditions of campaigning were very challenging, famine and high mortality during at least the retreat phase of campaigns mounted to the east. It was not a developed part of the empire, and they resisted bitterly Selim's intentions to attack first Iran in 1514 and then Egypt in 1517. So there were plenty of sort of forces mitigating against a religiously defined conflict with Iran, and I don't really have time to rehearse all of them, but certainly the anti-case, the danger of destabilizing the regime domestically, especially in the Balkans, by stirring up sectarian divisions within Ottoman society domestically was there, and the danger of claiming the mantle of Sunni universalism until such time, or even after the subjugation of Egypt. It was controversial. The Arabs didn't want a Turkish caliph, necessarily. Oh, is that all?
Wait, fine.
Okay, so mitigating against a definition of state power in terms of religion, pro Ismail's case, yes, we need a foundation myth, we need a raison d'etre. It can be and perhaps must be defined in terms of an external foe or an encirclement by our Sunni neighbors, but propelling to peace. The forces are quite, or some kind of accommodation, the forces are quite, and the logic is quite certain, and the logic propelling towards conflict and sort of polarization along religious lines are strong, but only for a time. So what I explore in the paper is the position of the Safavid state, sort of redefining itself in terms of a Persian heritage, which predates the rise of Islam, of identifying and elaborating a dynastic foundation myth that skirts a bit suppresses a bit the notion of a hieratic state, a theocratic state, a state based on defense of the right. In theological terms, and a state which must come to terms for its own survival and must gather within forces supporting the monarchy or the authority of the Shah that are more broadly based than a fundamentalist, militant, and enthusiastic following that had existed under Ismail but had lost the credibility of Iranians who needed to support a regime who had multiple sources of internal strength and multiple reasons for defending the regime's legitimacy. So Shah Abbas, which is the main focus of my paper, took the throne in 1588, ruled until 1629, elaborated in his own chancellery, which is the part which I probably won't have time to read to you for my conclusion, but you have there on pages maybe 11 and 12 towards the end of my paper, that he elaborated a kind of cleansed, if you will, state ideology that could relate to its neighbors in terms of our greatness, in terms of Persian heritage, in terms of authority based on the justice and the good administration of the ruler, and which marginalized this narrative of statehood or of mission of state to win a battle on theologically defined terms. So it's a greatly simplistic overview, but you gave me two empires, so. But basically, what I wanted to say in the paper was that a language was elaborated for declaration of war. I think we had this yesterday with Vaucher, where he talked about states go to war based on a very careful calculation of cost-benefit. Once they go to war, then the machinery legitimizing war kicks into place, and that there's a whole elaborate sort of choreography of justification and legitimization of confrontation of either a Christian foe. And in the co-religious sphere that we're talking about here, Muslim against Muslim, it was very difficult for the Ottomans to sell the idea to public opinion within their own empire to go on crusade against the Safavids. It simply did not carry much weight of conviction. So that being the case, I think we have to see what you find. It's certainly true in interstate correspondence, the evidences of irresolvable religious difference being formulated, being expostulated, being said, if you will. The voice and tone of interstate correspondence is, you're a heretic, you're a schismatic, I'm justified in going to war against you because you're not really a real Muslim. You are kafir. And this is a formal part of the Ottomans' declaration of war against the Safavids each time. Ikfar. Infidel, not Muslim. Therefore, it's legitimate for me to. So this sort of forces of light, forces of darkness vocabulary imposes itself at the point of war's declaration, at the point of war's inception. But there is a counter-narrative, which I think is not explored enough, and that is the narrative of accommodation, of coexistence, which comes in the elaboration of their peacetime relations. So I have studied, for the paper's context, the language and the shift in the tone of language from anathemizing and demonizing of the enemy or the opponent to this language of accommodation, and the banning of explicitly insulting the religion of the opponent in public manifestations such as tabara, which is a technical term, but it means the cursing of the first two caliphs, of the succession after the Prophet's death, who were regarded by the Alids as illegitimate, and all their successors as also illegitimate claimants to the caliphate or to religious leadership within the Muslim world. So the Ottomans didn't attempt to enter into that debate very much, but their hand was forced, of course, to declare war. It was required by custom, by tradition, to find a justification, a pretext for attacking a Muslim state neighboring them that had some basis in this is God's will. So this is what I explore in the paper. It's probably an inadequate summary of that, but you have some indications in the written version, I hope. And I apologize for not daring to use my lycée French to address you on these important subjects.